Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Chuck Cairns about emergency medicine, and we're going to be introducing a new feature to our show today that Christy and I are very excited about, a new coast-to-coast correspondent that we'll tell you about in just a minute. But first, Christy, we have some research that matters to people.
We sure do. This first one is about multivitamins and colon cancer. And it speaks to the belief for so many of my patients and people across the world that multivitamins might help to either treat cancer, to prevent cancer, or to slow it down.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even outside of the cancer realm, I mean, I take a multivitamin every day when I remember it. and I think it helps me, and I don't think it hurts me. But if I would start really looking at the evidence maybe like this, I don't know. Does it really help me? And that's what this research starts to look at in terms of colon cancer.
Well, and apparently 26 to 77% of cancer survivors report using multivitamins and supplements. So this was a study where they followed more than 1,000 people who had recently undergone surgery for advanced colon cancer and found that about half of the patients reported using multivitamins after that surgery.
Yeah, and they followed these folks, of course, and for 6 months and after chemotherapy, and this was in the Journal of Oncology, and looked at things like improved survival, how long did the patients live, or how long before they got disease recurrence before those who were taking the multivitamins compared to those that were not, and unfortunately, there was no difference.
So at least for the available for this study and what's out there, we don't know that multivitamins make a difference to, or at least for what we know, they don't make a difference to prevent cancer or to improve cancer prognosis. But it may be that other specific vitamins like vitamin D, there's more research about that, and other dietary things you could do that may make a difference, but we need to study it more.
Right. And so let's talk, Christy, just briefly about this next research that matters. We always talk about things that you can do to help your health. And we've got a couple here today that may be things that may not be helpful, like the multivitamins. And this was about text messages and their use in health communication. And I was so excited when I first read this.
Well, I was excited, too, because, in fact, one time when I was very sick, I had to take a lot of medicines, sometimes three times a day, four times a day.
And programmed it into your iPhone?
I sure did. I programmed a memory.
Did it help you remember to do it?
It did. It told me which pills to take at which time of the day, and it helped me.
Well, this particular study was really fascinating because they looked at the use of self-text messages to help women remember to take birth control pills, which is critical because so many people and women, forget doses, and you're talking about possibly getting pregnant.
Right. I mean, missed birth control pills accounts for 1 in 5 of the 3.5 million unintended pregnancies in our country. So it's a big deal. And if we could improve, taking the pills, maybe we would prevent those unintended pregnancies.
And they took 82 women who were on birth control pills, and they gave them either a daily text message reminder to take them, or they didn't get the reminder. But if they didn't get the reminder, they still got some encouragement, and they were given some tricks to try to how to remember to take their pills. And so what did they find?
They found no difference. So both groups over the three-month study missed about 5 pills a month.
And, which is amazing.
Which is a lot.
Scary.
Yes. And but neither group, I mean, there was no difference between the groups. So in this study, at least over the 3 months, the people who got the text messages didn't seem to work.
Yeah. And there was some thought that, that the interest in participating in the study got people real interested in taking their pills. And the women who got the tricks up front, even though they didn't get the text message, so that it may not be that the text message doesn't work, and
right.
It doesn't say that the use of this sort of technology, because I'm a firm believer that I would floss more if my pager or phone went off right after I ate lunch every day and said, remember to floss. I know I would floss more.
Maybe the message could be more personal. So lots of potential, I think, with this area of research.
Or to say something nice about us.
What if it said, Adam?
You're a good person. Remember to floss.
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, those are the two research studies that we have to talk about today, but we have our new segment, Coast to Coast.
Yeah, we're so excited to bring a new segment that will be a regular feature where we have a wonderful correspondent in Seattle, a former family physician, Dr. Peter Curtis, with us today.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Curtis.
Thank you very much.
It's really great having you here, Peter. I've known you for a long time. You're one of my mentors, and it's so great to now have you as part of Your Health as a coast-to-coast correspondent.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, as Adam and I were thinking about starting these conversations with you, we were hoping that you might tell us a little bit about yourself in the context of what people in North Carolina and people that are listening to our show should know about you.
Well, it's a long story, and I'll keep it short. I grew up in England and trained in medical school there in London and took a career path as a specialist in rheumatology and physical medicine. And then sometime during that period, I did what's called a locum, which is a stand-in for a country doctor up in the north of England in a wild area, the place where the vet used to, who's famous in All Creatures Great and Small, practice.
Yeah. Wow.
And I became very enamored of country practice and family practice. I got a lot of benefits from the families and their life. And so I decided to give up being a specialist and become a family physician.
A convert.
And I know you were really one of the first family physicians really in the U.S. and in North Carolina, and really were one of the founders of the Department of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina.
Yeah, I came over on a sabbatical in 73 and to help start the residency program. There was a lot of anxiety about the shortage of primary care physicians in North Carolina. So I came for a visit for a year to help start the program and then got recruited back 2 years later.
And you were in the department for quite some time before you left North Carolina.
Yes, 33 years.
Wow.
Well, I know over the next days, weeks, months, and years that you're able to be with us on Your Health that you will be telling us lots of stories and things that are on your mind about the experience. I hope sometime we'll get into some of the research you've done. It is groundbreaking, if not interesting at the very least. One of the things you've been working on out there that actually I think is really interesting to all of our listeners is you have this interest and involvement in something called a virtual village. What's that about?
Yeah, the virtual villages, there are about 60 of them in the States, and they're community-based initiatives which the local members of the community, usually led by one or two retired specialists, have organized themselves to provide services to seniors who wish to remain in their homes. There is a problem that more and more elderly people cannot afford to go into nursing homes or retirement communities and desperately want to stay in their own homes. And
this is one of the ways that they're experimenting with how to do it. If people want to find out more about this virtual village, how do they find out about it?
Well, there's a website called vtv.com, virtualvillages.com. And if they go to that, they'll be able to find a list of the villages. Most of them are on the East Coast. Some are on the West Coast and in the central part of the country. And I think the issue is that we are facing what might be called a quiet crisis of aging in this country.
Yeah, and I'm not even so sure it's so quiet anymore, really.
A demographic tidal wave, they call it.
Wow. We're going to need to wrap up right now. I know we want to come back and we want to hear about the progress of the virtual village. I know Christy and I want to go take a look at this. I'm a little closer to the senioring aging than she is, but I know we want to look into this. But I hope we can return to that. And I know we're going to talk with you again in a show again soon.
Okay.
We've been talking with Dr. Peter Curtis, our new Coast to Coast correspondent, and we look forward to hearing what's on your mind next time.
Well, Adam, that concludes the Research That Matters and Coast to Coast segments of our show. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Chuck Cairns about emergency medicine. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about challenges of emergency medicine. And you know, Adam, we've discussed before to our listeners, this is certainly near and dear to me, as my husband is an emergency medicine doctor trained at UNC. And so these are issues that we talk about on a daily basis and are important to our listeners who may need emergency care.
Yeah, Christy. And I think almost every listener has some experience with the emergency room. And it impacts people, and it's there when people need it. But it's also part of a growing problem that we've had with healthcare reform and emergency rooms at the front and center. So we're really thrilled today to be able to talk about some of these challenges that the emergency room represents and that people have with Dr. Chuck Cairns. Dr. Cairns is professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Cairns attended medical school at UNC and completed his emergency medicine residency and emergency medicine cardiology research fellowship at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Returning here to take over as chairman of the department, Dr. Cairns is active not only as a clinician and a researcher in emergency and critical care, but also as an educator, training the generation of physicians who take over emergency rooms in places across the country. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cairns.
Well, thank you very much, Adam and Christy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you. And one of the things Adam and I love to start with our guests is to hear a little bit more about your path, about what made you excited about emergency medicine, which is a young field, especially at the time that you you chose it as a career path. Tell us what made you excited about it.
Well, it's really a pleasure. Indeed, I was interested in emergency medicine before there was a Department of Emergency Medicine here at UNC, and frankly, there were very few departments of emergency medicine across the country. But I, at the time, I was at UNC during the summers doing research in a trauma surgery laboratory where we were trying to think of new ways to treat people who had bleeding, and the bleeding would lead to organ dysfunction and failure. We call that hemorrhagic shock, and it's the leading cause of death after severe injury, and unfortunately remains so today. But in that quest, we were looking at everything from blood substitutes to a new way to monitor it, and started thinking and talking about how we could go right to the source of injury, pre-hospital, frankly, pre-field, and thought about how military medics had evolved in Vietnam and some of the good they had been able to do, and potentially we could start to apply that to civilians, cities across North Carolina, and put some of these concepts of early intervention in life-threatening injury. I then coupled that with the idea of studying cardiology, because clearly the heart's not just pumping blood, but has its own blood supply and can get damaged in this process. And so those two concepts of trauma and cardiac emergencies and how we might treat them right at the point of the patient got me interested in emergency medicine.
Let me ask you a question. You know, you talk about this journey, really, for yourself and getting interested in a field that didn't exist two decades ago. In addition to really this emerging field of emergency medicine, this emphasis on what one can do, how has that changed in the last two decades? Can you give us some examples? You kind of gave us one example through the kind of the research, but what are a couple things that have really changed has how people approach thinking about emergency medicine?
Well, there have been a number of remarkable developments in the last 20 years. First one is is that emergency departments have become very popular and prolific.
is that a good thing?
Popping up everywhere.
Well, can you imagine when emergency departments were kind of destinations for a very small number of patients, usually brought by ambulance systems, which weren't very developed 20 years ago, to now over 120 million patient visits a year in emergency departments across the United States. And the second key interesting evolution's been now 50%, frankly, at UNC, over 50% of all hospitalizations now come through the emergency department. So when you think about it, the emergency department has become a very large part of the healthcare system in those 20 years. And I think part of that stems from demonstrating success. We've been able to prove that we can save patient lives on a time-dependent basis by having systems of care, and there are about 14 conditions where we've proven that we can reduce death rates, what we call mortality, based on time, measured frequently in minutes. So you need to have an organized system that can take people from their place of work, home, school, and get them definitive care as quickly as possible. And so I think we've had success in terms of taking that construct and applying it to a broad population. So I think that success of showing that time-dependent illness and injury is important and we can save lives, coupled with this explosion in the number of emergency departments, the size, and their place in the healthcare system.
And when you're talking about the time-dependent illnesses and conditions and traumas, you're talking about things like stroke or like early treatment of pneumonia. Well, name some things that really make a difference so our listeners know.
So one of the first ones we proved was in heart attack. Now we've been able to show that heart attack care is measured on the time span of minutes, and that literally minutes in treatment delays cost lives. So we have time-dependent treatment that can open up the closed arteries when someone's having a heart attack, and now prove that improves both the duration and quality of their life. And so our goal right now is for any patient who has a heart attack anywhere in Orange County, or frankly anywhere across North Carolina, and get them diagnosed, get them up to the catheterization laboratory, get a balloon into that artery that's affected, and open it up all within 90 minutes.
Wow, and that saves lives.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Chuck Cairns, the head of the emergency department at the UNC School of Medicine, about some of the challenges in emergency medicine. And listening to Dr. Cairns, it makes me think one of the challenges is really deciding the problem that I have, do I need to go to the emergency room with, or do I need to go to see my doctor? Can you address that, and how do you think about that, and how has that thinking changed for you, let's say, over the last few years?
Well, it's a really important question, Adam, and thanks for bringing it up. I think that, you know, one of the challenges of the emergency department is that we're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, holidays and weekends included. So we're always available, and we need to be, because frankly, if we're going to take care of a heart attack patient within 90 minutes, we have to do that at any time of the day or night. So we're always quite convenient. I think that one of the challenges has been is that there are a number of people who come to the emergency department who may not need to be there, but it's sometimes difficult for them to know that by the time they get there. The other challenge that we face is we're recognizing that a lot of patients have atypical or unusual symptoms and characteristics, and maybe we don't understand disease as well as we thought we did. So I think any symptom that is clearly associated with a life-threatening disease, we need to know about. Frankly, call 911 and have the paramedics deliver you to the emergency department. They are, frankly, an extension of our care out in the field, and they can start to provide some time-sensitive care immediately. But for other people, I think that if you have, for example, difficulty walking or functioning, then that's something that we need to see. If it's a symptom that persists, you've never had it this severe, that's probably something we need to see. And clearly, when something unexpected's happened, especially an injury or severe illness, high fever, for example, a car accident, that's something we should probably see.
Those are good, good tips. We do need to take a short break, Dr. Cairns, but when we return, we'll continue talking about challenges in emergency medicine. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Chuck Cairns, the director of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the UNC School of Medicine, really talking about some of the challenges in emergency medicine. And right before the break, we were really kind of getting into and understanding how we've gotten to where we're at today. And I think, Dr. Cairns, one of the things, Christy and I would really like to know your thoughts about is this whole impression of when you come to the emergency room, because you are open 24/7, you may have to wait depending on the time of day, hours, maybe even up to a day, not to be seen necessarily, but you may have your total wait time there be long, long period of time before something happens to you. Talk to us about the pressures on the emergency room that leads to this and what's happening to try to address this.
Well, it's a very important issue, Adam, and frankly, we have become busier and busier. We continue to have a steady increase in the number of visits. And it's not just in Chapel Hill and Orange County, but across the country. And part of this has resulted in overcrowding of emergency departments. And in Chapel Hill, for example, we've really been trying to address the issue on the front side. So, for example, because of our dependence on getting to a diagnosis and getting treatment within a particular period of time, those time-sensitive illnesses, we've developed a way to screen patients and get patients seen almost immediately when they come in the emergency department. And that allows us to identify patients with pneumonia or heart attacks or strokes quickly. It allows us to provide comfort care for some people who are in pain or distress. And it also allows us to integrate the registration process with the initial evaluation process.
I wonder how much of that is the perception of the patient, where maybe a nurse has screened the patient and identified that this is not a true emergency, but from the patient's perspective, they haven't been evaluated for however many hours.
So we're trying to get, we're trying to screen not only for these time-sensitive illness and injuries, which lead directly to a treatment path, again, measured in minutes, but also to try to provide comfort care and reassurance to people who can wait a little bit longer.
Sure.
So we've been opening up new sections of emergency departments. We've been changing around our configuration of physicians so they get to see a physician quickly. But even with that process, there are times when we get busy. So we try to cover our bases for the time-sensitive care, try to provide comfort care and compassionate care for those who may have to wait, but always keep track of the clock because time's our enemy, at least in that evaluation.
Well, and you may be at times, I mean, you're not only having to provide that acute care, if there's no beds in the hospital and half of the admissions are coming in through the emergency room, you're having to keep the patients down there for stabilization. So you're having to do the kind of the chronic now hospital care in the emergency room while you're trying to triage. The complexity is immense.
So, Adam, you're absolutely right. So, you know, we talked about that front end and trying to get people seen and evaluated quickly. Why we have challenges on the back end as well, and that's after we've decided to admit people. We have people who unfortunately can stay in the emergency department a long time. Frankly, in some disease states like psychiatric disease, they can stay there for days, and it's a very challenging mission, taking care of people for days at a time for a system that's geared to take people with time-sensitive disease measured in minutes. So it's a very complex challenge, and obviously, we're trying to struggle with solutions to that, and we're making some progress, but we still have some ways to go.
Speaking of other challenges, and I know from talking with my husband that you're really at a lot, you're exposed to perhaps more legal risk than some other types of doctors and maybe might be potential to have a lawsuit brought against you, perhaps because the patient doesn't know you or just because you're dealing with more emergency-type care. And that coupled with perhaps patient expectations of getting a full-body CAT scan and totally thoroughly checked out from their perspective when they that may or may not be indicated. Speak to us about the challenges of navigating that.
Well, you're absolutely right, Christy. These are challenges. And, you know, frankly, the first issue is that someone who comes to see us, it's usually a bad day for them. And, frankly, it's one of the worst days of their life, if not the worst day. And so we recognize that they're under a lot of stress, strain, and challenge just due to that. We don't have a relationship with these patients typically. And so we have to learn to establish a rapport very quickly with the patients and their family. But during a time of stress, that can be difficult. And then finally, you know, these patients come to us with limited information, and we have to try to make a diagnosis, identify one of these time-sensitive conditions, and try to reverse it, despite the fact we may have multiple other patients in the department, despite the fact that they may not be following the typical textbook definition of disease.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, bad things can happen and do. People with severe illness and injury typically end up in the emergency department before they pass away, and so we recognize that these are risks and events that are going to occur. And having patients and families understand all those challenges, all that risk in the setting of uncertainty, can sometimes be a trying task.
Well, you know,
You
bring up the question that, you know, we started with that there wasn't training programs 2 decades ago, and we now think and hear all of the skill sets that you're describing that require tremendous training to develop compassion and rapport quickly, to develop the expertise in acute medicine, to have knowledge of chronic disease, and we haven't even gone into the psychological mental health that overwhelming and the social place that the emergency room is. And even preventive care, right? I mean, you are being called upon to institute prevention treatment, smoking cessation, to immunizations. Tell us about the challenge of recruiting and training residents and others to take on this mission. Because I imagine not every hospital, particularly rural locations, has an emergency room trained physician.
Well, you're absolutely right, Adam. And frankly, there's a serious shortfall in terms of the number of available trained emergency medicine practitioners for the number of hospitals and, frankly, for the clinical need, just given this expansive role that emergency medicine and emergency departments now play in the healthcare system. And so there's going to be a challenge in terms of putting together a workforce to meet the current need, much less the expanded need in the future. But we're very fortunate in terms of our training program here. People like Christy's husband, we just get the outstanding medical student graduates. We have extraordinarily competitive residency where, you know, we'll get 1,000 applicants for our 10 spots. And
Well, how is healthcare reform going to change what we and what you're seeing in the emergency room, or is it?
I think it will change. In fact, if Massachusetts is any guide, the number of emergency department visits are going to go up. There just aren't enough primary care physicians to meet the pent-up demand for all those patients without insurance. And there'll be an increased demand for health care, understandably. They won't have enough spots to go to and primary care providers. So at least in the short term, they'll come to the place that's accessible and available, and that's currently the emergency department. So we anticipate that there will be an increase in volume with the initial phase of health care reform.
And what else do you see on the horizon for next steps for research in emergency medicine and next steps to handle those challenges?
Well, I think there are a number of fronts of interest in emergency care. The first one is the idea of regionalizing emergency care services, or at least specializing in particular disease states in particular institutions. We already do that with trauma in this state. There are certain places like UNC that are designated as trauma centers. So all the severely injured patients in a wide portion of the state will be sent directly here. We have similar programs in heart attacks. We're developing programs in stroke. And I suspect we'll be doing similar things for pediatric emergency medicine and other disease states. So I think that that trend of regionalization is going to continue.
And I know from our perspective, this cooperative team approach that we no longer look at what's happening up there separate from our primary care practice. And I know you all look upon us as if we can help have a team approach, we can better manage. And so that part of this regionalization is also forming more collaborative teams.
Absolutely, Adam. In fact, we've really had a very good relationship with family medicine here at UNC. And the idea of matching primary care needs in medical homes, especially for patients who don't have insurance, so that we can get them the care they need. They can get that preventative care that you mentioned, which is going to be so important in the future. But also from our standpoint, making this a system of care, a collaboration of care. And I see that as certainly a major trend in the future.
Absolutely. Well, we can't thank you enough, Dr. Cairns, for the work that you're doing at UNC and for our state, and certainly for being with us today.
And for training Christy's husband.
Yes, thank you for that.
Well, that's been a true pleasure, as has this show. Thank you both very much for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Chuck Cairns of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will talk about your health questions, experiences, and attitudes.
And we want you to write us and share your questions and experience with us. And we'll talk about them on an upcoming show, at least give you our thoughts and opinions. We want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can call us at 919-966-8081. So we'll have our producer, Julie Steiner, read our first house call.
Dear Drs. Page and Dr. Goldstein, I'm 63 years old, and I'm having a problem with my big toe. It has been slightly swollen for the past few weeks, and every now and then it will swell up more and cause me pain. I don't remember injuring it, but I was wearing flip-flops a lot when this first started. I don't remember a bug bite or anything that could have started it. When I asked my doctor about it, it wasn't very swollen at the time. She asked me about drinking alcohol and mentioned the possibility of gout. Do you have any ideas?
Well, we always have ideas.
We do.
That we won't suffer from. And, you know, the first thing, actually, Christy, it's so funny because I think about my late father who always used to laugh, who said, you know, that I should specialize because he really liked family medicine. But this idea of specialization, he said, you know, you should specialize and only do things of the person's big toe. So if I were that specialist,
really good at that.
I could have taken care only of this one today. But I think we maybe have some ideas. What do you think of?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, gout in the big toe is a common place for that to happen. And certainly if you're drinking alcohol, that can bring it on. So that's a possibility, although you'd think it would hurt more than what you're describing. Hard to know.
Yeah, and you know the irony, of course, is if the gout only hits you when you got the sandals on, bad timing. But there are other things that sandals, you know, you might actually have strained or walking differently or less padding, and you can get bunions and corns and just strained toes.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you injured it and didn't realize it at the time. And so there could be some healing if you had broken a little bone or if you had stretched the ligament there, you could have injured your toe.
Big thing here is work with your doctor that you've already seen. They can do tests to really look into this with x-rays and blood work. They could tell you pretty easily, I think, if it's gout or not. And they can probably tell you some other things to do, like maybe get some better shoes for a little while to see if that makes a difference.
Okay. Hopefully that's helpful.
What's Julie? Next?
My primary doctor called me to ask me to come in for an appointment due to a notification from my insurance company. The insurance company sent the doctor a notice saying I needed closer follow-up since I'm on a depression medication and need to be screened for thoughts of suicide. It turns out that I did have those thoughts several months ago, but I'm now under treatment from a psychiatrist for this. I came in and spoke with my doctor about it, who reinforced my relationship with my psychiatrist. My doctor also spoke with my psychiatrist about certain medicines that could be influencing my mood. In the end, it was a good thing that my main doctor found out, but it made me feel a little weird that she discovered it through my insurance company. What do you think about this?
Wow. I mean, I think it's... It's unusual, the situation that the doctor found out through your insurance company, but...
I don't know. I mean, I unfortunately, I increasingly over the last couple of years do get letters, you know, not necessarily brought in from the patients, Christy, but I do get the letters from the insurance companies making suggestions for patients' health all the time based upon their review of medications. And that feels a little weird to me, too, at times.
It does feel weird. But in this instance, it sounds like it's really a time where that effort on behalf of the insurance company may have really made a difference for your care.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the – I'm not sure I like the means, but I like the outcome.
Right. And if that's everyone working together with the insurance company, not as the evil one, but as someone who may be – helping in you getting better medical care, then I guess it's a good thing, provided that your privacy is still intact.
Yeah, but I think that uneasiness you're feeling, I think we also share a little bit of uneasiness because we're getting into a world that maybe we don't know what we don't know, like the things that could happen or the downsides to some of this information sharing,
right.
Privacy concerns. So I think having that healthy uneasiness is still a good idea.
In the end, thank you for sharing with us, and it's good to hear that you're getting what it sounds like you're getting what you need from both your primary doctor and your psychiatrist, and we're glad you're feeling better.
What's next? Our next house call.
I provide services for a man who has mental retardation. He had a vitamin D level checked, and it was 27. What does this mean? What do you recommend for a low vitamin D level?
That's a really good question. Reminds me of that health literacy that we had recently on our show, Dr. DeWalt, talking about communication about things and sending lab results to patients, Christy. We might say it's low.
Right.
But that doesn't really mean – what does that really mean? This is a great example.
So in this case, this would be considered vitamin D insufficiency in that it's lower than 30, and generally we consider less than 20 as deficient. So it is a bit of a low vitamin D level, but not scary low, I guess.
No. And we would usually recommend just a vitamin D supplement anywhere from 500 to 1,000 international units a day. A lot of our patients are taking it. I'm taking it even because my vitamin D level is too low.
I'm taking it too.
You know, so not real hard. And thanks for the question because I think that's a common thing that a lot of people experience, which is not really fully us saying what it means when we send lab results out, or maybe we tell you what it is in the clinic and don't give you enough information.
Right. And don't forget you also get vitamin D from the sun. Julie, what do we have next?
My daughter had tubes put in her ear 6 months ago, and I never went back for follow-up with the ENT, which is a long story. I don't know if the tubes are still in place, but I've noticed that every time she gets a cold, her left ear drains. Sometimes it drains a foul-smelling, thick material, and sometimes it's clear. How do I know when it's infected and when she might need an antibiotic?
Those are – it sounds like there's a lot of questions.
A lot of questions there. And just first off, tubes are literally little pipes. They're little small tubes that go in the ears to keep people from getting – who have chronic ear infections to help them kind of get over them. And ENT is ear, nose, and throat. So just get that medical jargon explained.
And it sounds like you went to an ear, nose, and throat specialist to get these tubes placed. And what that does is it holds – it pokes a little hole in the eardrum and allows the fluid, when you get a cold or get an illness, to then drain out so that it doesn't make cause as many problems as if those tubes were not in place. So it allows a space for it to go. The fact that you hadn't followed up with the doctor, though, is a little concerning to me just because there can be complications and the doctor could help you answer some of these questions.
You know, the discharge that you're having coming from there may mean that the tubes are doing what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You're getting that drainage. So you would really hope that it's not continuing. And that's the real reason to go back now, even, because you would have expected that this would have all cleared up. And in one of the years, mm-hmm. at least, it's not. There's still stuff happening there. Really need to go back, talk with your doctor, find out what's going on.
Okay. Well, hopefully we have addressed some answers to the questions and experiences that you've had. And
had a chance to talk about the tubes and the ear, nose, and throat doctor and the insurance issues.
And we talked a little bit about vitamin D. And
the big toe gout specialist.
Oh, yeah. Adam's going to be a big toe specialist one day in his future.
Well, thanks so much for everyone listening and being with us today for your health. We hope the issues and concerns we've talked about are important to you. You can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or you can follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Chuck Cairns.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.